Life is complex. Join us for the simple gifts of wisdom, love, and delight in the written word. The Everlasting Man by G.K. Chesterton. Part 2 on the Man Called Christ. Chapter 5, The Escape from Paganism. Part 3. In Christendom, hope has never been absent. Rather, it has been errant, extravagant, excessively fixed upon fugitive chances. Its perpetual revolution and reconstruction has at least been an evidence of people being in better spirits. Europe did very truly renew its youth like the eagles, just as the eagles of Rome rose again over the legions of Napoleon. Or we have seen soaring but yesterday the silver eagle of Poland. But in the Polish case, even revolution always went with religion. Napoleon himself sought a reconciliation with religion. Religion could never be finally separated even from the most hostile of the hopes, simply because it was the real source of the hopefulness. And the cause of this is to be found simply in the religion itself. Those who quarrel about it seldom even consider it in itself. There is neither space nor place for such a full consideration here. But a word may be said to explain a reconciliation that always recurs and still seems to require explanation. There will be no end to the weary debates about liberalizing theology until people face the fact that the only liberal part of it is really the dogmatic part. If dogma is incredible, it is because it is incredibly liberal. If it is irrational, it can only be in giving us more assurance of freedom than is justified by reason. The obvious example is that essential form of freedom which we call free will. It is absurd to say that a man shows his liberality in denying his liberty. But it is tenable that he has to affirm a transcendental doctrine in order to affirm his liberty. There is a sense in which we might reasonably say that if man has a primary power of choice, he has in that fact a supernatural power of creation, as if he could raise the dead or give birth to the unbegotten. Possibly in that case, a man must be a miracle. And certainly in that case, he must be a miracle in order to be a man, and most certainly in order to be a free man. But it is absurd to forbid him to be a free man and do it in the name of a more free religion. But it is true in 20 other matters. Anybody who believes at all in God must believe in the absolute supremacy of God. But insofar as that supremacy does allow of any degrees that can be called liberal or illiberal, it is self-evident that the illiberal power is the deity of the rationalists, and the liberal power is the deity of the dogmatists. Exactly in proportion as you turn monotheism into monism, you turn it into despotism. It is precisely the unknown God of the scientist, with his impenetrable purpose and his inevitable and unalterable law, that reminds us of a Prussian autocrat making rigid plans in a remote tent and moving mankind like machinery. It is precisely the God of miracles and of answered prayers who reminds us of a liberal and popular prince receiving petitions, listening to parliaments, and considering the cases of a whole people. I am not now arguing the rationality of this conception in other respects. As a matter of fact, it is not, as some suppose, irrational. For there is nothing irrational in the wisest and most well-informed king acting differently according to the action of those he wishes to save. But I am here only noting the general nature of liberality, or of free or enlarged atmosphere of action. And in this respect, it is certain that the king can only be what we call magnanimous if he is what some call capricious. It is the Catholic who has the feeling that his prayers do make a difference when offered for the living and the dead, who also has the feeling of living like a free citizen in something almost like a constitutional commonwealth. It is the monist who lives under a single iron law, who must have the feeling of living like a slave under a sultan. Indeed, I believe that the original use of the word suffragium, which we now use in politics for a vote, was that employed in theology about a prayer. The dead in purgatory were said to have the suffrages of the living, and in this sense, of a sort of right of petition to the supreme ruler, we may truly say that the whole of the communion of saints, as well as the whole of the church militant, is founded on universal suffrage. But above all, it is true of the most tremendous issue, of that tragedy which has created the divine comedy of our creed. Nothing short of the extreme and strong and startling doctrine of the divinity of Christ will give that particular effect that can truly stir the popular sense like a trumpet. The idea of the king himself serving in the ranks like a common soldier. By making that figure merely human, we make that story much less human. We take away the point of the story which actually pierces humanity, the point of the story which was quite literally the point of a spear. It does not especially humanize the universe to say that good and wise men can die for their opinions, any more than it would be any sort of uproariously popular news in an army that good soldiers may easily get killed. It is no news that King Leonidas is dead, any more than that Queen Anne is dead. And men did not wait for Christianity to be men, in the full sense of being heroes. But if we are describing, for the moment, the atmosphere of what is generous and popular and even picturesque, any knowledge of human nature will tell us that no sufferings of the sons of men, or even of the servants of God, strike the same note as the notion of the master suffering instead of his servants. And this is given by the theological and emphatically not by the scientific deity. No mysterious monarch, hidden in his starry pavilion at the base of the cosmic campaign, is in the least like that celestial chivalry of the captain who carries his five wounds in the front of battle. What the denouncer of dogma really means is not that dogma is bad, but rather that dogma is too good to be true. That is, he means that dogma is too liberal to be likely. Dogma gives man too much freedom when it permits him to fall. Dogma gives even God too much freedom when it permits him to die. That is what the intelligent skeptics ought to say. And it is not in the least my intention to deny that there is something to be said for it. They mean that the universe is itself a universal prison, that existence itself is a limitation and a control. And it is not for nothing that they call causation a chain. In a word, they mean quite simply that they cannot believe these things, not in the least that they are unworthy of belief, We say, not lightly, but very literally, that the truth has made us free. They say that it makes us so free that it cannot be the truth. To them, it is like believing in fairyland, to believe in such freedom as we enjoy. It is like believing in men with wings, to entertain the fancy of men with wills. It is like accepting a fable about a squirrel in conversation with a mountain, to believe in a man who is free to ask, or a god who is free to answer. This is a manly and a rational negation, for which I, for one, shall always show respect. But I decline to show any respect for those who first of all clip the bird and cage the squirrel, rivet the chains and refuse the freedom, close all the doors of the cosmic prison on us with a clang of eternal iron, tell us that our emancipation is a dream and our dungeon a necessity, and then calmly turn round and tell us they have a freer thought and a more liberal theology. The moral of all this is an old one, that religion is revelation. In other words, it is a vision, and a vision received by faith. But it is a vision of reality. The faith consists in a conviction of its reality. That, for example, is the difference between a vision and a daydream. And that is the difference between religion and mythology. That is the difference between faith and all that fancy work, quite human and more or less healthy, which we considered under the head of mythology. There is something in the reasonable use of the very word vision that implies two things about it. First, that it comes very rarely. Possibly that it comes only once. And secondly, that it probably comes once and for all. A daydream may come every day. A daydream may be different every day. It is something more than the difference between telling ghost stories and meeting a ghost. But if it is not a mythology, neither is it a philosophy. It is not a philosophy because, being a vision, it is not a pattern, but a picture. It is not one of those simplifications which resolve everything into an abstract explanation, as that everything is recurrent, or everything is relative, or everything is inevitable, or everything is elusive. It is not a process, but a story. It has proportions of the sort seen in a picture or a story. It has not the regular repetitions of a pattern or a process, but it replaces them by being convincing as a picture or a story is convincing. In other words, it is exactly, as the phrase goes, lifelike, for indeed it is life. An example of what is meant here might well be found in the treatment of the problem of evil. It is easy enough to make a plan of life of which the background is black, as the pessimists do, and then admit a speck or two of stardust, more or less accidental, or at least in the literal sense, insignificant. And it is easy enough to make another plan on white paper, as the Christian scientists do, and explain, or explain away somehow, such dots or smudges as may be difficult to deny. Lastly, it is easiest of all, perhaps, to say, as the dualists do, that life is like a chessboard in which the two are equal, and can as truly be said to consist of white squares on a black board, or of black squares on a white board. But every man feels in his heart that none of these three paper plans is like life, that none of these worlds is one in which he can live. Something tells him that the ultimate idea of a world is not bad, or even neutral. Staring at the sky, or the grass, or the truths of mathematics, or even a new-laid egg, he has a vague feeling like the shadow of that saying of the great Christian philosopher, St. Thomas Aquinas. Quote, every existence, as such, is good. On the other hand, something else tells him that it is unmanly and debased and even diseased to minimize evil to a dot or even a blot. He realizes that optimism is morbid. It is, if possible, even more morbid than pessimism. These vague but healthy feelings, if he followed them out, would result in the idea that evil is in some way an exception, but an enormous exception, and ultimately that evil is an invasion, or yet more truly, a rebellion. He does not think that everything is right, or that everything is wrong, or that everything is equally right and wrong. But he does think that right has a right to be right, and therefore a right to be there. And wrong has no right to be wrong, and therefore no right to be there. It is the prince of the world, but it is also a usurper. So he will apprehend vaguely what the vision will give to him vividly, no less than all that strange story of treason in heaven and the great desertion by which evil damaged and tried to destroy a cosmos that it could not create. It is a very strange story, and its proportions and its lines and colors are as arbitrary and absolute as the artistic composition of a picture. It is a vision which we do in fact symbolize in pictures by titanic limbs and passionate tints of plumage. All that abysmal vision of falling stars and the peacock panoplies of the night. But that strange story has one small advantage over the diagrams. It is like life. Another example might be found, not in the problem of evil, but in what is called the problem of progress. One of the ablest agnostics of the age once asked me whether I thought mankind grew better, or grew worse, or remained the same. He was confident that the alternative covered all possibilities. He did not see that it only covered patterns and not pictures, processes and not stories. I asked him whether he thought that Mr. Smith of Golders Green got better or worse, or remained exactly the same between the age of 30 and 40. It then seemed to dawn on him that it would rather depend on Mr. Smith and how he chose to go on. It had never occurred to him that it might depend on how mankind chose to go on, and that its course was not a straight line, or an upward or downward curve, but a track, like that of a man across a valley, going where he liked and stopping where he chose. Going into a church, or falling drunk in a ditch. The life of man is a story, an adventure story, and in our vision the same is true even of the story of God.
'Tis the gift to be simple, 'tis the gift to be free, 'tis the gift to come down where we ought to be, and when we find ourselves in the place just right, 'twill be in the valley of love and delight. When true simplicity is gained, to bow and to bend, we will not be ashamed. To turn, turn, will be our delight, till by turning, turning, we come round right.